Welcome to the Repair Ed podcast, where we reflect on education and reimagine equitable futures. I'm Claire Neves, a researcher who worked in education in the city of Bristol in the southwest of England for over 15 years. In each episode, I'll talk to educators and thinkers about current injustices in our schooling system and their ideas for creating fairer educational futures. This podcast forms part of Repair Ed, a five-year project funded by UKRI to examine educational inequality in Bristol's primary schools. Welcome to another episode of the Repair Ed podcast. My guest today is Lauren Mattel, a teacher and parent in Southend-on-Sea. Lauren also co-founded Southend Care Bank, a charity that works to alleviate hygiene poverty. Morning, Lauren.
Morning.
Can you tell us a bit more about yourself and share how you got into teaching?
Yes, of course. So I've been a teacher for coming up to 12 years now. I worked for 9 years in Tower Hamlets as a primary school teacher, and I now work more locally to me down in Southend in Essex. So I became a teacher kind of by accident, actually. I never really wanted to be one. I wanted to work in kind of film. I wanted to be a film archivist or a historian. Then I wanted to teach kind of film theory at higher education. And I accidentally stumbled into primary school teaching and just went, this is it. I spent one afternoon in a local primary school in East London, and that was it. I decided, I wanted to be surrounded by noisy, sticky children for the rest of my career.
Oh, that's great. That's quite similar to me, actually. I didn't ever kind of have that dream of, you know, always wanting to be a teacher. But then when I tried it, I was like, oh, yeah, this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's your teaching journey been like? So I know you said you've been teaching for 12 years, but you've also done some other things in that time, haven't you?
Yes. Yeah. So I was at my school in East London for, 9 years. 9 years. I trained there. I had my baby there. So I took a year out for maternity leave, went back, smack bang in the middle of COVID. Mm. It was quite a difficult time for everyone. We lost our head teacher to COVID. Commuting into London was very difficult. And I think when you kind of have a baby and you go back to teaching, you look through it completely differently. I started questioning everything. Mm. In hindsight, I was burnt out. But I was like, this isn't what I want. Why is it important? I was questioning everything. Why are we, do we have to make the children line up quietly? Why is that important? Like, what is the point of this? And my assistant head teacher at the time, she'd also previously experienced burnout, and she just said, I think you might just need a change. You don't quit teaching. Maybe you've outgrown this school. Try another school. And so I got a job locally. It was not the right school for me. Didn't align with my values. And I said, right, that's it. I'm not supposed to be a teacher anymore. I cannot do this anymore. The system is utterly broken. I'm broken. I cannot achieve anything within this. And I left teaching December 22, absolutely convinced I was never going to have another classroom, never have another class. I gave everything away. Mm-hmm. All the years I'd collected all these books, for my, you know, my book corners, all my resources, everything I gave away. I just was like, I'm done. And I started tutoring and coaching. Mm. And I started working as I was a part-time one-to-one outreach teacher. I worked with a teenager with very complex needs, which I loved doing. I got to use all of my skills, but also develop so many new skills as well. And I was doing lots of, I was doing growth mindset coaching. I was running after school clubs, but it just wasn't what I imagined it was going to be. I missed the relationships that I get a chance to build with children over a year. And that, to me, I just was like, I need to go back. I need to get back in the classroom, see how it is. And so I went back just over a year ago, last Easter, and I another local school. And it's been the best decision I've made.
Fantastic.
So, yeah. Year and a half out was enough. I was burnt out. I wasn't done with teaching. I was burnt out.
Yeah. And I think it's been really good. So from my perspective, I've sort of followed that journey a little bit online and, you know, seen you coming out of teaching and doing something else and then and going back in. And it's really nice to see those people who go back in because they've still got the passion for it. Because you're right, it's the system is so broken, and you know, we'll talk about that a bit in a moment. And there's burnout is immense amongst teachers, and so it's really lovely to see you thriving, which we'll come on to later. But I think you touched on some of the things that you didn't agree with in the system. So our project, Repair Ed, focuses on educational inequality through the lenses of race and class. And I just wondered if we could chat a bit about where you've seen inequality in the system.
Yes. So I guess it's only now I'm working in a town that is quite diverse, class-wise and racially as well. And I mean that in the actual sense of being diverse. Whereas the first almost decade of my career, I spent working in a school where 48% of the children were living in poverty. I think nearly 90, around 90% of our children were Bangladeshi. The remaining kind of, I think, 8% were Somalian. So it wasn't actually very diverse. While it allowed me to develop my practice in a very, it encouraged me to develop my racial literacy very quickly, which I don't think a lot of teachers get to do. And I only realised how lucky I was when I stepped out of that and went to work in schools that are very literally diverse. Where I work now, we've got very middle class children and children from the very bottom end of the lowest, you know, lower socioeconomic scale. So it is very diverse. And I'm working with white teachers, white middle class teachers that haven't always got that experience of supporting the needs of children from perhaps the backgrounds that I have. So for me, it became usualised working in Tower Hamlets. My practice was completely developed around that kind of normalisation of class and race and that lens and approaching everything through that lens. And we were taught to, we were trained to. My you know, senior leadership, all the guidance, all the training I had, it was around that. So to step out of that 3 years ago now was a real shock. And I think it has to inform everything we do, whether we are working with white middle class children or not. I think it has to inform everything you do.
Yeah, and I've heard from quite a few people how different things are in cities like London and Birmingham compared to Bristol. And I think, you know, you've hit on it there, that the thing is in Bristol, teachers aren't trained to see everything through those lenses.
No.
We're sort of rolling out an approach that works for one group of children and just expecting all other children to fit into that. Whereas, you know, in other cities where you've got a lot more focus on how do we make things work for these groups of children, things seem to be done very differently. I know teachers who've come from London to Bristol are often quite shocked at how segregated things are here and how differently things are approached. And I wondered about Southend-on-Sea being a coastal town. Are there any kind of unique challenges there with it being kind of a coastal community?
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting area. You've got pockets of wealth, in some areas, obscene wealth. You've got areas, it's now one of the places people are selling up in East London and moving down to Leigh-on-Sea, Chalkwell. And you've also got extreme deprivation as well. Hence why I started the Southend Care Bank. You've got a huge mix. It's very diverse. One of the things I really struggled with as well in my first term working locally was the school I'm in is very, very close to the town centre, very close. And the mobility of students, only about 40%, I've been told, 40-50% of our kids start in reception and finish in year six. So we are getting lots of kids coming in and then leaving because we get a lot of people in, coming into the area for temporary accommodation. We have a lot of looked after children in the area. We house a lot of asylum seekers and refugees in the area. There's a lot of temporary accommodation in the surrounding areas. So it's a lot of mobility. Yeah, it's a very interesting place to teach.
Yeah, it sounds it. I wonder whether now's a good time, sort of thinking about your local context. Could you tell us a bit more about the work that you do in Southend generally? So I know you co-founded Southend Care Bank.
Yeah, so it's a small charity. We weren't a small charity. We were like a mutual fund, mutual aid organisation. We kind of saw a need. We knew I paid a visit to the local food bank coming up to about 4 or 5 years ago now. And they were telling me about what they do. And they said that they have in the whole place, they had one shelf for the toiletries that they couldn't keep stocked. They said, you know, people don't donate toiletries to us, but also like we can't keep the stuff in long enough because people really need it. But also if you are accessing a food bank and you've only got a limited amount of things you can take, are you going to take food to feed your family or are you going to take shower gel? So we started it as a very, very small mutual aid initiative during lockdown that started with us putting boxes in local kind of businesses and asking people to put stuff in. We had an Amazon wish list and it was chaotic because we didn't know what we were going to get. Things would just turn up at my house. And we just used to operate out of the church doors and give just what we could. And as the years have gone by, we've become a charity. But we knew, I'd done the research before we started. We've got a huge, I can't remember now because I did it, you know, 5 years ago, but one of the highest rates of people sleeping rough. Huge amount of unhoused people in the area. So we initially thought we were going to be supporting a lot of unhoused men. And actually what we still find shocking all these years later is the sheer number of families and women we are supporting. And particularly those from kind of marginalised identities. Lots and lots of people. We support a lot of asylum seekers in the local area. A lot of women of the global majority. So what we were how it's turned out is very different than what we were expecting. And our number, we increase each month the amount of people we're supporting as well.
Yeah. Do you see that that's a job that increasingly schools are doing as well now?
Yes.
That sort of, you know, I know there are lots of schools with food banks in. There's some stuff on our project website about that, because there's been some research around food banks in schools. But yeah, is that something that you see at your school with kind of supporting families with those essentials?
Yeah, I mean, we keep a stock of uniform in school. I literally have packets of socks in my desk drawer. I haven't paid for them, the school, they have come from the school, but I keep socks in my desk drawer for children who, you know, come in with their socks on in the morning. My charity works closely with my school and many schools in the local area, providing school holiday packages, because we found that sometimes numbers for our visitors to the sessions dropped during school holidays, and we assumed that was because of the cost of public transport around here. It's sky high. If you're trying to get yourself and say three children on a bus, the cost of that is actually more than the products we are providing. So we now do school outreach every school holidays. We provide packages. We are kind of very friendly with a local charity as well that provides school uniforms packed with smiles. They work really closely with all the local schools as well, providing uniforms and other kind of bits, backpacks and pencil cases and things that, that children need. Schools are desperately plugging the gap, absolutely. And as budgets decrease, the ability to do that is also decreasing as well.
Yeah, and that's something that we're encountering with a lot of the research we're doing in schools. Teachers are telling us about the money that the school's having to spend on things which are, you know, they're not educational, but they are. There's a moral imperative.
Yeah.
You know, if you've got hungry kids in front of you, you're going to feed them. If you've got kids who don't have the right clothes, you're going to provide those. So, yeah, schools are really feeling that stretch. Let's move on to sort of some of the things that you do in your class, because that's really why I wanted to invite you on the podcast. So I know of you through social media, where I've loved hearing about the conversations you have with your class and the insights you share about teaching in the current climate. So I guess I wanted to ask, like, how is what's going on in the world at the moment? And I know that's such a broad term, but hopefully we'll touch on some specifics. But how is that shaping your teaching and your interactions with the children you teach?
It always has. Obviously, things feel so much worse. They are. It's always shaped my practice. I became a teacher before I became a mother, but I was already an activist in some senses. You know, I'd been a feminist since my early teens. And it was only kind of after a couple of years, I realised that actually all three informed, they are inextricably linked. And during my NQT year, I'd been teaching only a few months when, I don't know if you remember, the Charlie Hebdo attack on the Paris office.
Yes.
The terrorist attack. And having to address that with my year four class in a circle time. And it was almost in that moment I realised this can be done. It can be done in a child-appropriate way, a way that keeps the children safe but allows them to explore these really big things. And again, I think working with a marginalised community for so long, you see the impact, the very real devastating impact that real world politics and what's going on in the world affects these children. And how you have to be addressing it in real time. You know, those children walk through that door at 8:30 wanting to talk about Grenfell. 9 years old, that was it. The community I work in now, most of the children are not so kind of well-informed in current affairs, which is interesting because they're spending so much time on social media. I find that really interesting, whereas 10 years ago, 8 years ago, 7 years ago, these children would come in and desperately want to talk about what was happening and how it affected them and their families. So that they taught me so much. The kids taught me so much about how important it was to give them space to talk about these things, because it affirmed them, it comforted them, it validated them, it made them heard, and it made them realise actually they counted. They had a voice that deserved to be heard. So And I guess by the time I started working with children who are kind of less motivated to discuss real world issues, I'm now well practiced in, I'm quite confident, I'm very confident actually, in kind of gently encouraging children to explore things, perhaps in a, you know, in a more creative way, you know, through the curriculum, rather than them coming in and wanting to talk about a terrorist attack straight away and having a circle time. It's actually, how can we explore a big theme through a picture book?
Yeah, so what are some of the things that you talk to your class about? Can you give us an example?
It's not a lot. There's not a lot that's off limits. in an age-appropriate way, absolutely. So currently, well, my English unit, we've been doing since May, we're reading the book Holes by Louis Sachar. It's a standard year five, year six text. Most year five, year six children going through the British school system will read Holes.
Yeah.
It's a really good book. It's even better if you know what you're looking for.
Mm.
So it is so rich with discussion on all forms of social justice, gender, class, race, the prison industrial system, legalised slavery. So obviously I've gone to town with that. And getting the kids to really explore things that impact them. So that's one way, that's one thing we're doing. We're celebrating Pride. It's really hard to fit these things into the curriculum, but there are ways of doing it. You know, 10 minute reading comprehensions. I know that like lots of teachers cringe at the idea of relying on something like Twinkle for resources, but Twinkle is it's a completely different resource than it was 10 years ago. I can literally each morning type in LGBT History Month and a fact file on someone like Marsha P. Johnson will come up. You know, ready-made in child-friendly language. I can print that off and my kids are exposed to really important history that they should be learning about. So there's lots of things. I don't really shy away from anything with kids. I feel quite comfortable talking to them about most things, whether it's war, history, you know, helping them decolonize their approach to history and understanding what Winston Churchill really was like. I don't, you know, yeah, I'm happy to talk to kids about anything.
That's great. And my next question was going to be around sort of holding the tension of getting through the curriculum at the same time as sort of wanting to educate your class about what's going on. And I guess you've answered that already in terms of thinking about how you weave it into the curriculum, because I think a lot of people out there will say, you know, for example, stuff around Pride or LGBT History Month or decolonizing the curriculum, they feel that that's kind of an add-on and there's too much in the curriculum to do that. But what you're doing is showing how it can be in there whilst practicing these skills. You know, the children have a reading comprehension. That's something that they've got to do. They've got to improve their reading comprehension.
Yeah.
But that topic that you give them for that reading comprehension can be where you get in some of that enrichment and those really essential things that you want to stimulate discussion around.
Yeah, I think the more you do it, the more confident you get. I would advise planning in advance. So again, another standard Year 6 text is Goodnight, Mr. Tom. It's about an evacuee in World War II, but we were able to really explore children's rights through it, and the concept of children's rights through Goodnight, Mr. Tom class. You know, there's lots in there if you know how to look for it. but it can be done. It's not perfect. Like, you know, I don't get me wrong. I don't spend all day, every day talking about social justice with my kids. Sometimes they feel like I am, but there are always opportunities. But I do often wait for children to raise things that are particularly big. So it's a balancing act. It really is. But there are ways of fitting it into the curriculum.
Yeah, so let's talk a bit more about the potential tension between talking about those things that are going on in the world and this duty to stay politically neutral as a teacher. And I know that's a particularly interesting one because I don't think we've ever really been able to fully grasp where that comes from and the extent to which it's true. I think there's this real kind of perception that you can't say anything as a teacher. You know, we know that as teachers we can't promote any particular political party or agenda, but you know, that's not quite the same as staying out of these discussions completely and never offering our own opinion. But I think some teachers feel like that's where they have to sit. So yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
So I think there's a big difference between being politically neutral and stating facts.
Mm.
So teaching my kids about Windrush Day on Friday, I'm stating facts when I tell them what a hostile environment involved, you know, creating a hostile environment and who created that hostile environment. That is stating a fact. And children, when presented with facts, you'll find have a very, very deep love of justice. They have a very intense sense of justice when presented with factual information. And I think, I don't believe discussing human rights is political. Human rights are human, they are universal. So I don't shy away from teaching my kids about Refugee Week. Learning about refugees is not political. I'm very confident in knowing where that line is. So teaching my children about a hostile environment is stating a fact. And when someone asks me my opinion, I said, my opinion is that no human being is illegal. That is not political. I don't believe that human beings are illegal. And when I ask them a question to get them to explore their thoughts, what is a border? What will you tell me what a border is? I'm asking you a question. That's not political. That's a question. It's a geography question. I'm teaching you that these countries have been carved up into arbitrary areas separated by lines. You tell me what you think that means. Who did that? Who benefits from that? That's not political. That's teaching them how to think for themselves. Again, a few years ago, part of the Year 5 curriculum I was teaching was the history of democracy up until modern times. And part of that was, we'd teach about the suffragettes, which was probably my favourite thing to teach, because that's when you can start drawing lines between current activists and what is celebrated in the past. But also teaching them about modern politics. So this was 6 years ago, 5-6 years ago. They had to form their own political parties. So we separated them. They had to create manifestos, but they had to learn about current manifestos. And we had pictures of current party leaders up on the board. And who are these? You know, ask them, what do they know? Who are these people? 5 years ago, and probably still now, if you put a picture of Boris Johnson up on a classroom board, it would be met with boos. Without any input from me, children aren't stupid. They're the very opposite. So it's not about us. Well, we are to remain politically neutral, but I don't think human rights are political. And I don't think political neutrality means not teaching children to think for themselves. We should be teaching children to question everything. And that includes who holds the power and who are they working for.
Mm. And there's a parallel there with something that's really, really well established in British schools, which is religious education. You know, we teach about the six major world religions, and, you know, you far more rarely get parents coming in and saying, oh, you're trying to push views one way or another on my children. You know, it's accepted that these are beliefs that we teach about, and, you know, politics should be the same. And I think with children are exposed to so much through, you know, TV, social media. You know, I know my child is always kind of hearing snippets of things on the radio and saying, oh, what does that mean? What are they talking about? And if you don't have those conversations with children, then you leave them ignorant, which is far more dangerous, I think, than developing that kind of critical thinking with them and that political literacy. So it's a really important thing to do. Have you ever had any pushback, though, from parents or, you know, other staff?
Interestingly, no, not really, not to my face. Not at the school I was working at Tower Hamlets, not at all. More locally, yes. At the school I spent a couple of, I probably spent 6 months working there, I was told by a member of senior leadership not to teach my year three class about Black History Month.
Wow.
Yeah. Even though a parent had come to me and said, her great-grandmother, her daughter's great-grandmother came over on the Windrush, she's part of the Windrush generation. This is the first time she's heard about this at school. So, and I was told, no, they learn about it in year six. That's fine.
Oh my gosh.
That's okay. So I'd already added my notice in. I was like, yeah, this is not the right place for me. But as a teacher, you think, should I be staying? Should I? Is it my duty to stay here and fight this? Because who else is going to fight it? But like I said, I hadn't realised that I was burnt out, and I couldn't. To me, it was, this is just another sign that I shouldn't be teaching. Not me directly, but it was my planning, was criticised for teaching children about the meaning of the black poppy for Remembrance Day.
Gosh.
None of this phases me. My teaching is grounded in research, history. Mm-hmm. I kind of do what I want to an extent, but it's always backed up by fact. It's backed up by evidence. It's always, you know, I'm not out there teaching my kids about conspiracy theories. Mm. I'm teaching them what I wasn't taught at school, that I've gone on to learn about as an adult. Mm. You know, I work in a school where there's over 40 different languages spoken. Like 48% of our kids are EAL, and it's a very racially diverse school. They need to be taught about the importance of the black poppy just as much as they do the red poppy and the white poppy and the purple poppy. But yeah, nothing major, no major pushbacks at all.
And it's kind of, I don't know, scary, I guess, and worrying to hear you say that those are things that have had pushback. You know, something as seemingly benign as saying, you know, we know what the red poppy stands for. There's also a black poppy, which particularly commemorates these people. And that's, you know, that is seen as something to criticise.
Yeah.
Is really worrying. And, you know, similarly, Black History Month, because when we talk to the people who are doing the work around decolonising the curriculum and trying to sort of insert some kind of justice back into the education system. You know, Black History Month is an example of kind of a really poor tokenistic way of injecting that into the curriculum. You know, Black History Month doesn't go nearly far enough. And if we've got schools where that's what they're doing in terms of diversifying and decolonizing the curriculum, we say, you know, well, that's not good enough. That's a month, you know. So for that to be criticized in a particular school is really worrying. And I think it just shows how different things are in different schools and how much depends on the leadership of individual schools.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, that the whole Black History Month debacle, part of it was also told, I was told, not only do they learn about it in year six, but are you qualified to teach? Am I qualified to teach PE? I had one training session as a trainee teacher. You still let me go and do that twice a week. So do you want me to present you with my reading list? Like, because I can present you with the CPD I did in East London, the anti-racist teacher training that I did, because I can present you with all of this, and it still wasn't good enough. No, we don't think you're qualified. So we'll then hire more Black teachers then, if you want them to teach it. But yeah, it shouldn't fall on the heads of Black and brown teachers to be mining their own trauma when actually it's the responsibility of everyone.
Absolutely. And for the benefit of all children, which
all
I think
children.
Comes up a lot as well, that perhaps these things are only suited to schools with certain demographics, but actually, no, you know, it's really white middle class children who really, really need to be hearing these positive messages about people from other socioeconomic backgrounds, people from different racial heritage. Like, it's really to the benefit of all children if we broaden the curriculum and share all these. So I think now's a good time to move on to our final question, which is the same for all guests on our podcast. What would a just education system look like to you?
Where every child's needs are met, every child belongs, every child is seen, every child has a voice. A curriculum that meets kids where they are, not tells them where they need to be. Fully funded education system. You know, the dream, lots of space, lots of resources, time. No testing. Get rid of the tests. You know, I say that as a year six teacher still reeling after SATs. You know, it just get rid of it. It means nothing. None of it means anything. So to me, that's what it would be. One that teaches children how to love reading, not how to pass a test.
Yeah, absolutely agree. And I think, you know, the current system seems quite far off that, but I think, you know, there's hope in the kind of resistance of individual teachers like yourself in classrooms, you know, and hopefully we can have enough of these conversations to start to shift things and give teachers more confidence that, you know, in talking to their pupils about social justice, we're doing the right thing. We're teaching them history, we're teaching them facts, and hopefully inspiring them to go on to be teachers and, you know, improving the system in that way. So thank you, Lauren. It's been really great talking to you today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to the Repair Ed podcast. Please take a listen to our other episodes, and if you'd like to be a guest, get in touch. Our email can be found on our website, www.repair-ed.uk.